Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 9, delivered on September 15, 2009. The title of this lecture is Ratio Analysis.
Today, ratio analysis. This lecture will focus on how the ratios are calculated, the formulas. In Thursday's lecture, we're going to together take a set of financial statements and break out the ratios. And then we will be able to ask some questions and get some insights. What are the ratios telling us? We do not care about the numbers per se. We're not fascinated by our ability to use a calculator. What we do care about is what those ratios are telling us about a corporation, sometimes even about an industry. Just like what we did with this financial building these financial statements and looking at sources and uses of cash and cash flow and all that that we've just passed through. There are stories behind the numbers. What is this telling us? Let me give you an example. Just this, I think it was yesterday, was it? Maybe it was Friday. The latest numbers for the economic activity were released. We found that inventories of manufacturers on average fell noticeably. Inventories fell. Okay, now, let's put some teeth into that. What would that mean? Inventories fell in the manufacturing base in the United States. Up or down? Is that good news or is that bad news? Who says? Vote bad news, good news. Good? Good? What do you say? Don't be nuanced. Don't be nuanced. We're not Democrats. You're starting to do herd. Don't do that. It's good. Look. The damn, 50-50. Look. Think about it. Inventories are being depleted. What does that mean? Are the companies selling or not selling goods? They're selling goods, okay? So that means they're selling goods, but it means that they're not manufacturing enough to replace what they're selling. Inventories are falling, so that would mean that not as much is being made right now as is being sold right now. So if that continues, if inventories keep going down, what will that mean eventually manufacturers are going to have to start doing?
Reproducing,
increasing their production levels. Which would mean that manufacturing activity will go up. And if manufacturing activity goes up, what does that mean about how many people they need to work in their factories? It will go up. So all of a sudden, we can see the future. In a cloud, no question about that. It's hazy, and there's all kinds of things that can get in the way, but this could actually mean good news. Now, here's another thing that goes right to what you did. Inventories are falling. Would that mean that's a source or a use of cash? If inventories are falling, source. So cash is beginning to accumulate. So that means that what are the prospects of these companies having the money to start their operations kicking back into high gear? Will they not have money or will they have more money to do it? More. Cash flow is going up. So that means that they've got current money that they can use to get their production on a burst again. Now, does that mean that we're good times are ahead? Not necessarily. But at the same time, if inventories are depleting, that means that manufacturers are standing there saying, oh, wait, we're selling stuff. And then not too long in the future, we got to produce some stuff to replace our inventories because our inventories are going to go to zero and we can't have that. So ramp up production again, manufacturing activity lifts, and they have to hire people, which lifts the employment, which drops the unemployment rate, we should hope. And then more people have jobs, then that means that people have money, and that means that people go in and buy more stuff, which means that the manufacturers' inventories go down further, which means that the manufacturers have to boost their production again. We're in the upstroke of the economic cycle again. Yeah, that number right there tells me we are now in the first phases of a recovery, of an economic recovery. How long it will last, how strong it is, and what are the bad consequences, that's another matter. But that's a sign that we're in, and it comes from just thinking about what it means when inventories are declining. That means that they're selling stuff, but they're not making stuff. But that means that they better get on their ball and start making stuff later. Okay, here's the dry numbers of the ratios. Now, one thing that I have to watch out, there are a lot of arcane ratios out there that financial analysts have as their own pets and oddballs that you wouldn't see in most textbooks. And I'll resist the effort to show you some of the odd ones, but there is going to be one that's not in the book, and I do want to point that one out to you. But the first set of ratios traditionally that we cover are the liquidity ratios. Liquidity ratios. Okay, now the first one that is the classic is the current ratio. Current ratio is just current assets over current liabilities. Nothing hard about that one at all. All this does is tell you the balance between what the current assets are, and in other words, how many times over could our current assets pay our currently due liabilities? How many times over could our current assets cover our current liabilities? Ideally, we'd like, not necessarily, but we'd like to have this a little above one. Because that means that we are able to at least pay our current liabilities with our current assets. You don't want it too far over one. Obviously, you don't want it too far under one. And again, this is one of those things where there is no golden direction for it. Higher and higher and higher does not mean better and better and better. It needs to stay in a range. And that's one of those things that is part of managerial planning, where the financial people are involved. Maintaining this current ratio and other ratios within a band and having an actionable plan when they begin to move outside of the band either way. It's not enough to say, oh, geez, that ratio sucks. You need to say, all right, we know what to do when this ratio begins to have problems, and we can operationalize the plan to get it back into the band where it is of acceptable proportions in our company, based upon industry standards, based upon what we consider in our judgment to be proper. Now, the problem with current assets in and of themselves is that they include, supposedly this is liquidity, but current assets are not all of the same liquidity. The most illiquid of your current assets is your inventory. I mean, if you have to sell your inventory, I mean, you're going to, first of all, going to have to find someone to buy your inventory if you're that desperate to get to raise money, and you're going to sell it at dimes on the dollars if you're lucky. So in our next one, which is called the quick ratio, we deduct the inventory from current assets and say, if we had a fire sale to cover our current liabilities, how many times over could we do it? This number, sometimes you'll find that this number could be above one, but once you hack out the inventories, you're below one. Not horrible in and of itself, but it's something to keep an eye on. It's not just the quick ratio, it's not just the current ratio, it's the differential between them that matters sometimes more than just the numbers themselves. Okay, by the way, our name for this, you'll hear me call this ACID. This is the ACID test. The quick ratio is the acid test. And you'll hear me call it acid. Now, there's one that's not in the book. This is the only one I'll show you that's not in the book, is a third in the liquidity, which is technically called the absolute ratio. The absolute ratio is just your hard cash and marketable securities, the stuff that you can get rid of immediately over your current liabilities. If you had to pay, write a check right now, could you do it to cover all your current liabilities? This is called the absolute ratio, and in my end of the business, we call this burn. This is the burn test. That's an old term going back a long time, the burn test. If everything went to hell and you had to write a check right now to pay every one of your current liabilities from your bank checking account and from your money market mutual funds account, could you do it? Could you do it? And how many times over? Or how much of your current liabilities? If you told me that the burn was 0.6, that means that I could cover about 60% of my current liabilities with just cash that I could bring up at the end of, by the end of the day. Okay, that's what the burn does for you. It's an old ratio, and it's not one that you see too often anymore. And the term burn, calling it burn, is even older, I think. Okay, now, profitability. Profitability ratios. Profitability. The first one is gross margin. Gross is your gross income over your sales. Remember, that's revenues minus your cost of goods sold. Well, then that just tells you what percentage of your sales are you keeping after you've paid to make the products and get them onto the shelves. What percent of your sales is actually surviving? Here's a rule. You want that to be above zero, that margin, okay? If you're spending all of your money to make it, then you're obviously not in good shape here. Now, this can be all over the place. Gross can. Now, the gross margin is just the first of them. And again, there's a comparative. You look at these not just in by themselves, but you also look at them in comparison to each other. And then you've got your operating margin, which is EBIT over sales, after you've covered all your bills, except for your interest and taxes. What percentage do you have of your sales left? Again, you'd really like to have that above zero. It's never going to be above 100%. If it is, you calculated something wrong in your financials. It's got to be between 0 and 100%. Obviously, these margins are. And, of course, ideally, the higher, the better. The farther from zero, the better. But it also is shaped by the company, the industry, and all that kind of stuff. And your net margin is net income. Is your net income over your sales? How much of what you took in survives to the bottom line? How much of what you took in survives to the bottom line? And it's all over the board from one company to another to another. You can have companies that are up there. Hell, I've seen service companies that had net margins in the almost 70%. A company I actually worked on its financial statements. And then you can have them down below 1%. It just is all over the board. But remember, these are accounting numbers. They're not cash flow numbers anyway. So you have to always be a little careful about that. Now, here's your return on assets, ROA. Return on assets. And that's your net income over your assets. Now, this number, it takes a while to get these things to soak in. It's not going to, just because I say it doesn't mean you're going to see it right away. But what this does is essentially tell you, like a percentage, like the yield on your assets, in a sense. Now, again, obviously, these are accounting numbers. Net isn't cash flow because you've got things in there that were non-cash items. But in a way, what this is doing is it's telling you what yield you're getting on your assets. In other words, you've bought these assets. How much money did they earn? If you've got, let's say, $1 million in assets, and your net income is, let's say, $80,000, that would say that your assets this year had a yield of 8% in what you did with them. You got the idea that is you got, essentially, you invested $1 million in assets, you got $1 million. And so what is that doing as far as a return goes to you? So this is almost like it's an investment ratio is basically what it is. It's an investment yield. And then you could ask yourself, all right, what else could I have done with those assets that were worth $1 million? Well, I could have used them for something that earned me 7%. So that's good. We got better than that. Well, maybe something might have earned them 10%. Okay, that's bad. So what we're doing with them, they're not working as hard as they could in some alternate best use. But again, this is like a yield on the total asset base of the company. You like to have this better, higher. That's a good idea. One thing that I do worry about, though, is if the yield goes too high, that can worry me a little bit because you might be burning the assets. If I could probably flog you along for 5 days without any sleep. Just beat you, yeah, yeah, feed you drugs, pour coffee down your throat, and get you for 5 days. At the end of 5 days, you detonate. You just explode. And the parts of you go off and run away and join a hippie commune. That doesn't do me any good for the long haul. I haven't nurtured the assets. Not that I plan to nurture you, son, but there's a point where if I see the return on assets burning way too high, well, this is way above the industry average. This is cool. That tells me they're really just chewing assets up. They're not investing. They should have more assets in there, which would lower that ROA somewhat if I had a larger asset base. So it's not always, always bigger, bigger, bigger is better, better, better. Maybe not sometimes. And then the ROE, return on equity. Return on equity, and that's just to say net income over your total shareholder equity. Okay, those are the profitabilities. Those are the classic profitabilities. Now, the debt ratios. Our debt. Or the external equities, as I've heard them called in Europe. The debt ratios. Excuse me. Total debt over total assets. And that's debt to assets. I'm sorry, debt to assets. And in a sense, what this does is it says, what percent of your capital base is leveraged? What percent of your capital base is borrowed money, OPM? Remember, the total assets will be the total liabilities plus the shareholders' equity. So this total asset there in the bottom, that includes total debt and total shareholders' equity. So in a very real sense, this is just simply telling us what percent of this company is paid for OPM, other people's money. That's what it's saying to you. It's just a percentage, essentially, telling us the leverage of the company. Now, there's an odd theoretical matter in finance about what is the ideal level of debt as a percent of a company's total assets, of as a percent of the total company. Strangely, the theory says that the closer to one, the better. In other words, the closer a company is to being completely debt and no equity, the better, because of the gains to leverage. But that's highly dubious. Most companies have a target for this. There's another one. Oh, by the way, debt to equity. I should write this one down. Debt to equity is another version of this. Debt to total assets swings between 0 and 1. Debt to total equity would swing between 0 and infinity. But it's just the same thing. Total debt over total equity. Whether you're talking about these ratios, essentially are different perspectives on the same thing. Most companies actually have a target. And interestingly enough, it's one of those oddities that you'll see sometimes. Well, this company just issued $5 million in bonds. And you think, well, what did they do that for? What kind of a project was it? They didn't do it for any project. They did it to bring their debt to equity or their debt to total assets target ratio back into their target range. They just did it to keep their ratio where they believe it is at its best. You will see that there's, and I don't know how true it is anymore, but for many years there was an obsession: keep the target, keep on the target. So if you drifted too far away from the ratio's desired level, you would just issue bonds, or you would just issue stock just to get yourself back into the range that you saw as the optimal capital structure for the company. And that's something we're going to talk about later, is optimal capital structure. Although there was this odd thing in theory that seems to indicate that companies will aim at, logically, they would aim at pure debt. That's not the case in reality, because debt becomes more expensive as you borrow more as a percentage of your company, because the risk of your company goes up as you borrow more, which means your cost of capital is rising at the margin as you borrow more. So a lot of companies aim at a ratio because they say that is where our weighted average cost of capital is at its lowest. The cost of our equity and the cost of our debt is at its lowest. And they calculate this, and we'll do a little of those calculations to see weighted average cost of capital. Interestingly enough, if I were to write, do it like this. Weighted average cost of capital. In other words, what the total mix of your financing from common stock and debt costs you. And this is just a little graph just to show you what I'm talking about here. Let me do debt to assets, okay? Now, debt to assets swings between 0 and 1. Realistically, the weighted average cost of capital curve is like a horseshoe. There is a sweet spot between debt and equity. There's a sweet spot between debt and equity where your financing mix has the lowest weighted average cost to you. And if you get too much equity in your mix, then that would mean you're going to pay too much. If you get too much debt in your mix, you're going to be paying very high interest rates because you're a very risky company, because you're borrowing too much. So somewhere in here, and it's not at 50%. It could be different companies, different industries seem to have different bottoming out points. And it's mostly empirical. There's theory to it too, but it's mostly just probing around to see, okay, if we borrow more now, what does that do to our weighted average cost? Oh, it made it go up. Okay, if we use more equity, what is that? Oh, that made it go up, so we must be sort of near the bottom. But we'll get into that later in the course. But just to give you an idea, this debt-to-asset ratio actually is important, very important to companies, because there is an understanding that there is an optimal mix of shareholders and debt holders for a company. And if you get too far from that, you're actually paying more for your money overall than you would if you were near the target. So you'll see companies busting their butt to stay in this in a target range, or at, actually some of them are very clear, we want this debt to equity ratio at this value or within this very narrow range here. But that's that. I won't go into that too much. Here's a biggie: times interest earned. Times interest earned. EBIT over interest expense. How many times over can the money you've got just before you pay your interest checks pay your interest checks? So if I've got an EBIT of $100,000 and I've got interest payments that are expensed for this current period of $20,000, that would tell me that I can pay my interest five times over. Five times over. That's good news. Of course, obviously, if times interest earned goes below one, you're in technical default. You can't pay your interest, okay? Now, again, caution, this is not cash flow. But really, but again, too high is not any better than too low. If my times interest earned is way up there in the stratosphere, well, that means that I can pay my interest really well, no problem. Well, that would tell me maybe we ought to consider taking on a little more debt in this company. I mean, we obviously have a huge amount of money we could pay the interest payments with, so why don't we take on more debt? You say, well, why would you ever want to take on more debt? Gains to leverage. And I will bring that up if I have time here. I might actually bring that up today just to show you what I mean by gains to leverage. I've written down a note here. There's a ratio not in the book, and I don't think I'll do that one here. But, I'm not going to do that. Okay, your activity ratios. The book calls them asset activity ratios. These are your activities. Activity ratios. The activity ratios. Average collection period. This is your accounts receivable. That's your accounts receivable divided by your average daily credit sales. I'm running out of ink in this one. Let me do this. Now, if you're using annual financial statements, you would take total credit sales divided by 360. If you're using monthly financial statements, you'd use 30 to get your average, okay? If these were annual financial statements, you'd look at how many of your sales were credit, total credit sales, and you divide it by 360 to get your daily. And if you were using monthlies, you divide it by 30, just to get the average daily. Now, you're saying, you do know the 360 rule, right? Okay? You're looking, yeah. Traditionally in finance, and this will pass someday, and it will be sometime after I die, because I won't let it pass while I'm alive. We use 360 days in a year. Okay? A standard 360 days. Now, why do we do that? Because we've done that since God walked the waters. And why did God walk the waters with 360 days? Because even in God's time, there were five bankers' holidays a year. 360. Just use it for me, for God's sake. Be consistent. But there's actually, strangely enough, even in the old-fashioned way, 360, there's a place where we still use 365. And you think, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. Well, of course not. It's finance. average daily credit sales, we use 364 years. You'll see that we do that when we compound interest too, 360 days in a year, because there are five bankers' holidays in a year. And I don't care how many people, famous people, they give a holiday to, there were five originals. What are the five originals? What are the five? Give me one.
Christmas,
okay. Another one? New Year's?
Easter?
Thanksgiving?
Labor Day?
No. 4th of July, for heaven's sakes. Total blank there. Yeah, five bankers' holidays a year. The rest are just because we have to pay the employees even though we can't make them work. Labor Day, my ass. We're capitalists. Okay. This, by the way, what this does is this, as this goes up, that means your collection period is extending. Now, is that good or is that bad? Well, you know, if you give longer credit, you're going to get better sales. But at the same time, it would really be nice if people paid you at some point. If this just keeps going up and up and up, that worries me. Because in a sense, unless I'm charging them a fair interest rate, they're getting free money from me. They get my stuff and they're not paying me. So I worry when AR goes up too much. But I also worry if it's going down. It's stupid to say cash sales only unless you are Walmart, for God's sake. Most of us don't want to be Walmart. You see, you've got to find a balance. Credit sales are great because they get people to buy stuff that they can't afford. And that's wonderful. As long as they pay for it eventually or you can seize their house. But, okay. Now, the inventory turnover ratio. Inventory turnover ratio. That's just sales over inventory. Now, this tells you how hard your inventory is working for you. How hard your inventory is working for you. See, because essentially, again, this one's one of those that's in a band. If this number is too low, your inventory is fat. You've got a lot of inventory for every sale. In a sense, this is a factor too. If I found out sales to inventory, my inventory turnover ratio was 3, that would tell me that every dollar of inventory was generating $3 of sales. If it goes clear up, way down to, let's say, 1.2, every dollar of my inventory is generating only $1.20 of sales. Not so good. The harder it works for you, the better. Although I would worry if it goes up too far, that would tell me that the value of my inventory is really lean. And unless you want to give me a justification for just-in-time inventory management, I don't like inventory that is too lean, because that could mean that you're going to run out of inventory and then they're going to have pissed off customers. You don't have something to sell them. And your competitors across the street saying, we've got stuff to sell and you don't. So you don't want that so high that you are in danger of depleting your inventories and then losing sales to customers who've got something to sell their customers. It's always better to have something to sell to your customers than have nothing to sell to your customers. Total asset turnover. And again, this is a turnover in the sense that sales over total assets is just telling you how many times over your assets are producing dollars. If I've got total assets of $10 million and sales of $50 million, that tells me that my total assets, every dollar of my total assets, is producing $5 of sales. As that goes down, my assets aren't working as hard for sales. As it goes up, my assets are working harder. The problem, of course, is, as I had mentioned before, if that goes up too much, that means that you're really tearing your assets up. And if it just keeps going up and up, that worries me that we're not having enough capital investment in the company and all of that kind of great stuff. Now, there's a couple of market ratios here, and I'm going to separate these. I don't think the book does, but I think these are called market ratios. The classic is PE, the PE ratio. The PE ratio is just the price, the market price of the stock over the earnings, and it's usually last year's earning. It's current market price or an average for a short period of time per share over the earnings per share of the company, the EPS. And the EPS would be, of course, for the most current year, earnings per share. And this is called the price earnings ratio, PE ratio. It is essentially how much the investment community is willing to pay for every dollar of the last period's earnings. How much will the investment community pay for every dollar of last year's earnings? So if I were to tell you that the earnings per share of a company was $2 last year, and we would write that as E0 equals $2 per share, EPS, the earnings per share. If I were to tell you $2, that means EPS, that is actually shareholders' money. Last year's shareholder, the last period's money. Because we've taken out all the debts, we paid the debts. By the time you get to EPS, you're talking about all the debt bills have been paid. So this is shareholders' money down there at the bottom line. Whether the shareholders get it or not, that's another matter. You know, dividends, or will it be plowed back into the company. But that's shareholder money. Okay, so now when we look at the price earnings ratio, how much are investors willing to pay right now for one of those dollars that belongs to the shareholders? And you're saying, well, wouldn't that be like a one-to-one? No, because that $1 that belonged to the shareholders from last year's earnings, that is now earning the company new money, new money. So, for example, if I saw an PE ratio of 8, that would tell me that the investors are willing to pay $8 for every dollar the company earned last year. Meaning, in a sense, that the investors believe that every dollar last year will ultimately, as a present value right now, be worth $8 here in the current period. Again, what it's saying to me is that $8 is what I'll pay because I think that a dollar that the company earned in the last period is going to become $8 of my money somehow, some way, as a present value. That's essentially a way of thinking about it. Now, PE ratios in my early time, we talked about PE ratios between 4, 10, 15 was a little on the scary side. And then it just got insane. PE ratios went up and up and up. You got PE ratios of 50, 100. In the Japanese markets, there were examples of PE ratios of 1,000, 2,000. Insane. In other words, if you have a PE ratio of, let's say, 70, that would say that investors are willing to pay $70 for every dollar the company earned for them that was theirs last year. That's just mind-boggling. Fortunately, when the stock markets crash, these PE ratios come back down. I was just looking at Microsoft this weekend, and Microsoft's PE ratio right now is around 15.3, which simply says for every dollar that Microsoft has of shareholders' money from last year, people are willing to pay $15. They think that Microsoft's going to make about $15.30 for shareholders for every dollar it had for shareholders last year, that ended up for shareholders last year. Now, there's another one. There's market to book. And I'm not sure how excited I am about this ratio because book value of a stock really doesn't mean anything. The book value of a stock, you hear, well, this is really above book value. Now, who cares? Book value is just an accounting entry. But I bring it up here, market to book is price, the price per share, market price per share divided by the book value of the shares per share. In other words, your total owner's equity divided by total shares outstanding. Total owner's equity divided by shares outstanding. Book value per share. Book per share. And really, though, book value per share doesn't have any meaning in a market sense. So, you know, you can say, well, the market, and I hear financial analysts talk about this a lot. Well, the market to book is 12. That's good. Well, why is that good? The book value doesn't have, there is no physical money attached to retained earnings. There's no such thing as a retained earnings account. So there's really no such thing as a book value in a physical, tangible, usable sense to a company. Nothing. But that's my own personal bitch about that. What we're going to do on Thursday is I'm going to give you out financial statements, and just we're going to hammer through and work out these ratios and then just talk about what are they telling us? What is in there? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.